Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of November, Monday at 9, our All Things Political segment. We have a lot to talk about today. The news this morning that Senate Minority Whip Trent Lott is planning on resigning from the Senate this year and may make a formal announcement as soon as today. We'll talk about what's behind that, if anybody knows. Also today, President Bush and Al Gore are meeting in the White House. That should be an interesting conversation. We'll talk about how the Democrats are campaigning on Iraq and how their strategy may have changed. Mike Huckabee gaining ground in Iowa, even though he doesn't have a whole lot of money. What's that all about? Bill Clinton is heavily on the campaign trail for Hillary Clinton in Iowa. Is that a plus or a minus for her candidacy? And we have a lot more on the table. Our guest is Professor Darren Robert Shaw, Associate Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. His most recent book is Unconventional Wisdom, which examines across time survey data to inform the popular conversation about voting and elections in the United States. In 2006, he published The Race to 270, which analyzes the effects of TV advertising and candidate visits on the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections. He has published articles in a number of different publications. He also was senior national data analyst for the 1992 Bush Coyle campaign. In 1999-2000, he served as director of election studies for the Bush-Cheney campaign. In 2004, a consultant for the Bush-Cheney campaign and the Republican National Committee. He is also a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Shaw. Our phone number, as we get rolling on all things political, is 1-800-486-8655. 1-800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee today, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Professor Shaw, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. Good morning to you.
Let's start with the news, and there isn't, we don't know very much about this. Maybe you know more than we know. Senate Minority Whip Trent Lott planning on resigning before the end of this year. Do you know anything about it?
Boy, I wish I did. They don't seem to clue me in on these sorts of things very often. I've been just catching up, reading a couple stories on the MSNBC blog and the CNN blog, and I have no clue, even having read those things, why he would. I mean, you know, the retirement rumors started in 2006 before he ran for re-election, but he ran anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of figured, you know, that was the end of that, and he'd serve out his term. But, you know, I guess the official line is that he felt it was imperative to stay, you know, on the ship's head while he was dealing with Katrina and Rita in the aftermath. You know, I guess he's gone. It doesn't look like there's much debate about that. And mechanically, I guess Haley Barbour, the governor there, who's a Republican, chooses his replacement.
Mm-hmm.
And speculation's kind of centered on three or four people. The name I keep hearing is Chip Pickering.
Who? Who is that?
He's he's retiring, actually, his seat in the House. The speculation was that he had his eye on a Senate seat anyway. And so I don't know much about his particular relationship with Governor Barbour, but that seems to be the name that's getting a lot of, you know, mention early on, at least.
Mm-hmm. How old is Trent Lott? Do you know?
I don't know. I could look it up easily enough. But, you know, there was an there was an article this weekend I was reading in the Times, I think, about how the graying of the Senate, which is an interesting phenomenon because the Senate isn't exactly known as a bed of spring chickens to begin with.
But, it's true.
You know, there was I think the number was there was something like 40% of the Senate was going to be 65 years or older at the end of this term. And so that was in the back of my mind as I heard this. And the funny thing is, Lott has never struck me as being one of the older members of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you always have people like Byrd and before that Thurmond who, you know, finally, you know, went out. But I'm a little surprised. I mean, he's been the subject of a lot of controversy lately, as you know, and your audience knows. But there wasn't anything that sort of proximate that would suggest to me that, boy, he has to step down because of health problems or because of family problems or some sort of scandal. It doesn't seem to be anything like that, although, mm-hmm. you know, who knows, really.
Yeah, you always think health problems, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah, I think naturally you do.
Yeah. Let's talk about Mike Huckabee.
Sure.
Because he's just zooming on up in those Iowa polls. The guy doesn't have a whole lot of money. He doesn't have the organization, and yet people like him. What's it all about?
Well, you know, since last year on the Republican side, people, both at the elite level, you know, sort of party people and the punditry, as well as Republican partisans, you know, voters, have been looking for, you know, the authentic conservative candidate.
Right.
And then that, I think, fueled a lot of the mini boom we had for Fred Thompson last spring. And I think Thompson sort of disappointed people, you know, not to write an obituary prematurely, but I don't think he capitalized on that sentiment or the possibility there. But Huckabee has these little mini debates, you know, that get a lot of cable coverage and are watched by voters in New Hampshire and Iowa. Huckabee has been very effective in those debates.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's funny. Last summer, I was with some people in New York. One of them is a very, very smart Democratic pollster. And I asked him, give me your outlandish prediction, you know, for this race. And he said, okay, Huckabee versus Edwards. And everybody around the table says, oh, that's ridiculous. And he said, you asked me for an outlandish prediction. That is my outlandish prediction. But we talked about Huckabee, and he said that, you know, he had met Huckabee, and he said he's a nice guy. He's a smart guy.
Yeah.
He has a compelling personal story, which I hadn't thought of. You know, we always think of McCain as being the guy with a kind of compelling personal story, you know, POW
right.
and all that.
Right.
But he said, you know, Huckabee's a guy who had, you know, health problems and lost a lot of weight and, you know, these sort of things that average Americans
right.
can relate
to.
Yeah. And I came away from that last summer. So now whenever anybody asks me, at least over the next couple of months, they said, well, you keep your eye on Huckabee, you know, not having an original thought in my arsenal. After that conversation did kind of stick in my mind that, you know, that's right. He is a conservative, you know, not a... maybe a up-and-down-the-line conservative, but certainly kind of more recognizable than maybe a Romney or a Giuliani. And, you know, he does have this story. He is an energetic guy. He's come across well in the debates. And so he's done well in these small retail politic venues, you know, mm-hmm. Iowa, New Hampshire. And I guess the thinking is that will translate into money, right? That you know, mm-hmm. first you need to generate the hand-to-hand, person-to-person buzz, then the media picks up on it, and then the money follows. This year, it's going to be such a tough year for Republicans. I just think that there are a lot of people with very short arms and very mm-hmm. deep pockets. I don't know if he's going to be able to get that kind of money. I think Republican voters, that is, are really a wait-and-see crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the hope on the Huckabee side.
Well, why hasn't it come in already? He's already going up in the polls.
It's a good question. I mean, you know, what astounds me is the juxtaposition of Ron Paul raising all this money on the Internet. And Mike Huckabee not raising as much or proportionally as much, even though Huckabee has, you know, some media buzz and poll numbers on its side. So I can't quite figure out whether it just hasn't quite filtered down. People, you know, nationally on the Republican side just aren't paying attention. Or maybe we're just, you know, reading more into a 3 or 4 or 5 point surge in Iowa than everybody else is.
There's something, though, about him that's genuine. I've said this many times before, but you know who the guy is. And he said some statement on a show I was watching on cable last week that whatever comes out of his mouth is what he believes in. It's not the subject of a focus group. It's not the consultants who are telling him to say this. It's what he believes. So he never needs to get tripped up in a lie. And I think Americans like that.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it's interesting given that, you know, McCain was the, you know, authentic candidate in 2000, Straight Talk Express and all that. And I think he's been kind of lost as a non-insurgent,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a one of the front runners, one of the heavyweights. But I really think voters are just craving authenticity.
I agree.
You know, and so I think your observation is really apropos. I mean, we've gone through, you know, first the Clinton years and the Bush years, and I just think there's an exhaustion with politics
mm-hmm.
and partisan politics and positioning. And you know, even though Bush had this, I think, persona of being, you know, a straight shooter and things like, I think the war and just fatigue with the Bush administration and a lot of people around him has soured people on that. So, you know, he in no way satisfied their yearning for a more authentic, straight-spoken, you know, sincere candidate. But Huckabee also has the advantage of, you know, being pretty articulate and,
mm-hmm.
and having sort of set of views and you know, even though these other guys, Romney and Giuliani, don't necessarily come from the Beltway, it's Huckabee that strikes you as being kind of the outsider,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the guy who's had experience in Arkansas. And so I agree with you. There is something a little more refreshing and straight and less calculated about him than the other candidates right now.
And never underestimate how big it is to lose 110 pounds.
You know what? I think that is a big deal.
I do, too.
I really do. I think a lot of Americans, when they sort of look at it, go, wow, you know, that takes a lot to do that.
If he can do it, and, yeah. He'd change the whole fabric of American society. We'd all get thinner,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. Trent Lott, by the way, Rhonda tells me, is 66 years old, which is pretty young, actually. So.
Yeah, well, for the Senate, certainly so. Yeah, well, good. Your crack staff is better than mine here, which would be me and myself.
Me and your computer.
Yeah, me and my computer.
Rhonda is definitely a crack staff. We'll give her that always. What about on the Democratic side? And then let me ask you how important it is to whoever the Republican is, the winner of Iowa and the Democrats. Do you think Obama's really gaining significant ground? Is Hillary in trouble there or not?
Boy, you know, I think we play this game sometimes when, you know, just my friends and I, when we'll talk about a golf tournament, we'll say, you know, who do you got, Tiger or the field? Right, you know? And I think on the Republican side, if you said Giuliani versus the field, I think I'd still probably take the field.
Hmm, right? Really?
I think. I'm not quite sure about it. I would have said that a month ago. I'm not so sure now. On the Democratic side, Hillary versus the field, I'll take Hillary. I still just get the sense that inevitable is too strong a word, but she is a dominant front runner. And what's kind of interesting strategically is that she's initially, I believe, her staff's thinking certainly was that they could afford to lose Iowa, that they face significant organizational and sort of ground force shortfalls in Iowa, that Edwards was there in a big way, that Obama was there obviously from a neighboring state, and that you know, that was going to be really hard for them. And I think early on they were close to kind of not writing it off, but really downplaying it. Mm-hmm. And she's been so strong nationally that she's actually broadened the battleground. I mean, I think there's a strong sense in her staff that they could knock everybody else out with wins in Iowa and New Hampshire, and so they just assume go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so while that Iowa race is very close, I'm surprised and impressed that she's winning there. Now, it's not much. It's a couple points. And she did take a little bit of a beating after her debate performance, not the Las Vegas one, but the previous one. But Obama, I think, failed to capitalize in large part. I mean, this is a little too insider because I know most Americans aren't watching these debates, but I watched on Thursday, or 2 Thursdays ago, the Vegas debate,
mm-hmm.
and his just inexplicable inability to answer the same illegal immigrant's driver's license question that had tripped her up, you know, a week earlier, just absolutely blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that not, and again, I'm sorry, this is not a substantive critique whatsoever. You know, because he talked about, you know, well, a little, you know, you have a public safety dimension here, but you also need to enforce the laws. But it was just such a, you know, waffling type answer. And it was almost the exact same kind of answer that she had given, taken national flak for a week before. And
mm-hmm.
that was really, I think, kind of disappointing. I expected a little more from him in that regard.
I guess he does very well on the stump. I haven't heard him on the stump.
I've heard that several people have told me that his, and I have quite a few former students who are working for him, because he does real well with the college students. I mean, my students last spring even were extremely excited about Obama's candidacy. And a couple of former students have told me that his retooled stump speech, which actually takes parts of some of the things he had in the Democratic keynote address a couple of years ago, is really, really outstanding. He is, I think, far and away the most intriguing candidate.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I really think he's got kind of a tough road because the expectations in many ways are so high for him that his speech in 2004 was so powerful and that the symbolic importance of his candidacy is so,
right.
You know, so obvious. That the problem, I think, is that, you know, he's kind of perceived as being this, you know, multicultural John Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
in some ways, right? You know, the next generation. But I think they're really still futzing around with the specific substance and the issues that match the charisma and the symbolism of the candidacy. And that's, from a strategist's point of view, that's really tough. I mean, what are the issues of the next 20 years that he can tap into and that rally people? And I think the trouble is that he's got this persona of being, you know, the next generation, but his issue profile and his issues are kind of traditional, sort of standard New Deal Democratic type issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to knock him, it's just that I think a lot of people kind of go, well, sounds a lot like all the other Democrats. And it's, in some sense, it's not fair for him to have to, you know, think 20 or 30 years down the line while, you know, Senator Clinton and others are talking you know, basically 2008, 2009. But I think that's the problem with the expectations. He's having I think he's having some difficulty finding a substantive match to the charisma of his candidacy and his kind of general vision.
And Professor Shaw, why do you think Hillary Clinton is the front runner? What is it about that campaign? What is it about her?
Boy, I think celebrity is huge.
Mm.
And, you know, she entered this race with an enormous, you know, the term, I guess, in Hollywood is a Q rating, which is, you know, recognizability plus favorability.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's true that she's so, you know, pretty polarizing, it's also true that 99% of people know who she is. And so if you're talking about people volunteering, people giving money, you know, doing the stuff that makes a presidential campaign happen, she just had huge natural advantages. And I think she's got a very smart team around her. I don't see a whole lot that's innovative about her campaign. Not that I'm, you know, privy to a lot of the nuts and bolts, but I think it's sort of state of the art. She does everything pretty well. You know, it's almost like a team that has no real weaknesses. You know, she's not supposed to be terrific one on one, but she's okay. She's not terrific at press conferences, but she does all right. She doesn't give soaring speeches, but she gives okay speeches, and that coupled with the celebrity, and I think the real sense on the Democratic side that, you know, we like her. We've kind of wanted her. You know, she was symbolic during the 1992 campaign as, you know, kind of a aggressive feminist, you know, Democratic boomer, you know, from the 60s, who was unashamed, and I think those credentials still stand very, very powerfully with Democrats who go to caucuses and vote in primaries. Just a small observation, too. I think the fact that the Democrats won in 2006 kind of liberated them a little bit from more obvious strategic thinking. You know, the need to have a white male Southerner on the ticket, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that because they won an election straight up in 2006, I think there's a sense they can nominate who they want to.
That's
rather than, mm-hmm. you know, kind of get cute and look for, you know, someone from the border south or, you know, the sort of things that I think have been in the back of Democratic voters' minds for a while.
So do you think that any Democrat could win, no matter who the Republican nominee?
I think that the default right now is clearly a Democratic win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at the interesting thing is you look at the generic ballot, which is just, if the election were held today, would you vote for a Democrat or Republican for president? And the Democrats have, last time I checked, a 14-point advantage.
Oh, my, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Hmm. Now, you put flesh and blood Democrats and Republicans, and that shrinks a little bit. Now, part of that is not because the Democrats are unpopular. It's just because there are more Democrats out there. The Democrat coalition is still a majority coalition. It's bigger than the Republican coalition by, you know, 6 to 8 points. There are just more Democrats and Republicans. And it's a more diverse coalition. There are more kind of moving parts. And so it's hard to be all things to all people. You know, so they always have a little bit more defection than the Republicans. Having said that, you know, the latest national polls that I've seen have Hillary beating Giuliani by, you know, anywhere from 2 to 6 points,
mm-hmm.
which means, you know, you're giving up between 6 and 12 points from the generic ballot to the, you know, the real-life matchup. And I think that does reflect on the fact that even though she's well-known, there are a lot of Republicans who will rally against her. You know, a lot of Republicans who might say, yeah, it's kind of time for a change, you know, I'm looking around, but if you put Hillary versus Giuliani, they'll still end up voting Republican.
Let's welcome phone calls. We're doing All Things Political Monday at 9 is what always happens, and our guest is Professor Darren Robert Shaw, Associate Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. His most recent book is Unconventional Wisdom, which looks at time survey data to inform the popular conversation about voting in elections in this country. In 2006, he published The Race to 270, which looks at the effects of TV advertising, we'll have to talk about that, and candidate visits on the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections. He has also worked in 2004 as a consultant for the Bush-Cheney campaign and the Republican National Committee, and he worked as a survey research analyst in several campaigns, including senior national data analyst for the 1992 Bush-Quayle campaign. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Lines are open for you, so take one. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well. That address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And we start our phone calls with Bernie calling from Chicago. Hi, Bernie. Is everything okay here? Hello, Bernie. Are you there?
Hi, this isn't Bernie.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hold on a second? Let me go to Bernie. We'll go to you next, whoever you are. Bernie from Chicago. Hi, Bernie.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. My question for the candidate or for the professor is, in traditional American politics, there were times where the person who lost the primary became the VP candidate. And do you see that happening with a Clinton-Obama type of arrangement?
Ooh, good question. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on Senator Clinton, if she does win, to pick Obama. He does have kind of a rabid following. There's a sense that African Americans and young people would be particularly mobilized by Obama, and just it reinforces the notion that wow, you've got something really new with this ticket, a female candidate, African American, and so there's I think from her perspective, it would be a natural. I'm not sure from his perspective if it's what they want to do. I've heard a lot of talk from again, these are basically students of mine who've gone to work who said that there's a real sense of timing with the Obama people. That's why they ran this time around, right? You know, they thought that he's hot now. He'll be less of a new thing in 4 years or 8 years. And I don't know, boy, I tell you, the VP slot is you know, he would really be tied with, Senator Clinton's or President Clinton's administration. And, I'm not sure strategically that's what they want to do. And I have no clue whether they fit well together. There hasn't been a lot of kind of nastiness to this campaign. I know we picked up on some things this morning. You know, they're going at it on health care, but they certainly haven't said anything about each other that would lead me to suggest there would be any kind of irreparable split. I mean, maybe that's coming. So I guess I'd say that the Clinton people would really, I think, welcome that possibility. I'm not so sure the Obama people would think it's in their interest to take it, but, you know, who knows? I have no real insight as to what the Obama people are thinking there.
Where was I reading? Are you familiar with this piece, Bernie, and Professor Shaw? I was reading somewhere in the last couple of weeks that she's been shunning him at these debates. She doesn't really welcome him, that he feels slighted by her and is a little bit offended because he wants to be friends, and so that there's this tension. She doesn't refer to him very often. Doesn't shake his hand, doesn't say hi. I don't know if that's just untrue gossip,
You put Bill in a room with him for 20 minutes, and I'm sure he could undo.
There's no doubt about that. About anybody, yeah.
You know, I do think that that's for you and me and people with far too much political time on our hands.
I guess. Go ahead, Bernie.
Follow-up question. Because if you look at that, you know, the Democrats could tie up the White House for the next 16 years, correct?
It's always, the rule in politics is sort of the 12-year rule, you win re-election, and then the heir to the throne, who, you're right, would be, if this scenario plays out, would be Obama, would be kind of a natural if things go reasonably well. And then, it takes about 12 years for people to get kind of tired of, you know, this is sort of the Reagan to Reagan to George H.W. Bush, right? That after 12 years, everybody just got sick of it. And so that would be kind of the scenario. I wonder, though, the Obama people, though, would have to take a look and say, what's coming down the pike? I mean, how likely is it that she'll have a successful term? Because if the judgment is that it would be a successful term and then a reelect, then, I think you're right. There would be a strong set of incentives to kind of get on board that train. If, on the other hand, you know, you look at the tea leaves and you say, boy, there's going to be a huge economic crisis with the credit problems and the housing and the housing industry issues. Maybe we don't want to be a part of that. Let's bide our time and you know, regroup and run again in 8 years, right? Or if she were to lose in the general, then 4 years. So I think that the Obama people, from what I understand, are very, very astute and very strategic about this sort of thing. And I think they'll just kind of regroup after the primary. I mean, again, assuming he doesn't win, I don't want to you know, pretend like it's not possible. This doesn't happen. But I still think it's likely Xi wins, and they'd be faced with an interesting strategic judgment. But again, I think Xi'd have a lot of reasons to pick him.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, thanks for your time. Good
thanks,
show.
Bernie.
No, thank you.
Speaking of vice presidents and presidents, how about that meeting today between Gore and Bush? Are they going to chat?
I love these meetings. I understand just from, you know, I was involved in both of George W. Bush's campaigns, and my understanding was is that they were not unfriendly at all until, you know, very much after the 2000 election. Things got obviously pretty heated, but that they've had a couple conversations over the phone since then. And you know, are on reasonably good terms. The president, for all you know, his shortcomings that people have noticed and you know talked about and drag his approval ratings down, he's got a short memory when it comes to this sort of stuff. He doesn't, you know. The funny thing was, he was supposed to be the hothead way back in the day when George H.W. Bush was president. You know, W. was kind of seen as the enforcer. You know, that he held the family grudges, and George H.W. Bush would kind of, you know, ah, shucks, it's okay, they don't mean me any harm. But I think as he's gotten older, he's kind of taken on his dad's persona in that regard. I don't think he holds grudges. And Gore, I think from everything I've heard, is actually a pretty personable guy. So I think the administration also substantively is realizing that it needs to face up to, at the very least, public sentiment on global warming and to quit being behind the curve on that. So I don't know. I kind of think they'll have a good meeting. I mean, Gore's got to be pretty happy, right? You know, Nobel Peace Prizes, Academy Awards.
Sure.
He's had a good run.
Sure. Let's go next to Bob from Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, thanks, Bob.
Hey, professor, I'm a part-time resident of Austin, and I love Austin.
Hey, and, terrific.
Hey, one of the things I enjoy seeing down there is the bumper sticker. Somewhere in Texas, there's a village missing an idiot.
Oh, man. You should come to, as I was driving in this morning, I park in the Brazos lot over at University of Texas, and it's my my reality check on the world. I've sort of a, every great bumper sticker in the world is there. My favorite ones, and I've worked for the president, my favorite one is Yeehaw is not a foreign policy.
There you go. By the way, you have my sympathies. By the way, I just wanted to mention, last night I was channel surfing. I happen to come across a fundamentalist, and I forget who it is. I enjoy watching these once in a while because they are absolutely hilarious. He had Mike Huckabee on, and I think it was when he was a governor, and they were both looking up Bible verses together. Now, here's my concern. I do believe that the Democrats are going to take over the White House again next year, but I would be very concerned to have another person there that religion is such an intense part of their persona that they feel like they have a direct line to God, or they, like George, where he actually talks to God. That is a scary scenario, again, for another 4 years.
Let's see. I think it's going to be, I've read so much and kind of listened to so many people talking about social conservatives and the role of faith in the 2008 election, and whether there's a backlash against, you know, somebody like the president who's you know, genuinely born again in his faith. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a problem for voters. You know, the role of religion in this election is really complex. You know, I've seen a lot of polling numbers on Governor Romney, and the number of people who flat out say they will not vote for a Mormon candidate is pretty significant, and it's fairly significant amongst mainline Protestants. So I you know, I think it plays both in the Republican primary, you know, with Romney, and certainly in the general election, where there probably is going to be some skepticism. Candidates who have the same kind of philosophies or personal appeals that Bush had, there may be some voter backlash against those sorts of people. On the other hand, I do think what we were talking about earlier is still the case. I do think that there's something kind of reassuring about Huckabee and kind of personable, that I think he may do well in spite of that. By the way, I'm not predicting a Huckabee upset or anything like that. I think that right now, though, you know, he's probably Giuliani's best friend and Romney's worst enemy, just because he's a guy who could win in Iowa and sort of take over the mantle of the main challenge to Giuliani. And I don't, you know, front runners tend to win nominations. That's a rule we know from previous primaries. But, you know, I still think that all things being equal, Giuliani probably rather run against Huckabee than Romney at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's just time to get rid of this zealotry, this religious zealotry in the White House.
There's a lot of people who share that sentiment, no question.
Thanks, Bob. Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk about the president in his last year. The Times had an interesting article over the weekend that he is going to concentrate on smaller things that may be important to everyday people, but there isn't any grand strategy anymore, is there?
Well, yeah, I was thinking about this, kind of getting cleaned up and ready to come in the office this morning, and it really was a remarkable first term. Setting aside Iraq, which is huge, obviously, you had, tax cuts, No Child Left Behind, prescription drug plan, consolidation of intelligence agencies under the Department of Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, really, really significant legislative agenda and set of policies for a guy who lost the popular vote and won by a hair's breadth in the Electoral College. It was really something. For better or ill, sort of talking more from a, sort of strategist point of view than anything. And you counterpose that with the second term, where you had a concerted effort to reform Social Security. That was the first thing to try to do, and it went absolutely nowhere. And then the summer of, in the summer of 2005, on the heels of going nowhere in the spring with Social Security, Iraq kind of continued to deteriorate, and then you had Hurricane Katrina, and it just seemed to suck all the life out of the administration.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans got panicky and started, passing all these earmarks to try to save their seats in 06, which, of course, didn't work. So I think generally the sense that the second term has been much less ambitious and certainly much less successful legislative is absolutely right. What do you do about, I guess there's two questions. First is that inevitable? Is it always that a second termer has problems on that count? Yes, although I think kind of the natural disaster thing really crippled Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly Iraq hurt, obviously, but I actually think Katrina was critical and really hurting him. I think right now they're probably going back to what we call in baseball little ball. Getting guys on first, bunting them over, and that analogy, I think, holds with the sort of legislative agenda they want. They have been pretty aggressive and pretty successful from the administration's view on judicial appointments, both in the first and second term, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's probably a smart thing to do. It's probably all they can do right now because he is a lame duck and his popularity ratings in the 30s. And I think that's probably all Republicans have a stomach for right now.
And what about Iraq? The Times also had an article yesterday that talked about the fact that the Democrats are changing their strategy on Iraq because the surge seems to be working and keeping down the number of deaths. So their strategy is, well, that may be true, but there's still no political solution here.
Right.
The sides are still as far apart as they ever were.
Right. This is really interesting. If you talk to people in Washington, I think they're the Republicans. I was surprised in a couple conversations I had last week. They think that Iraq will really fade from the headlines over the next
really?
6 months. Yeah, I was kind of stunned by this.
Hmm.
And I didn't, no one ever trusts me. They don't tell me what they know. I couldn't figure out whether they meant that the situation, that the United States will come to some sort of consensus about a drawdown or timeline, or whether they thought that the situation would just become sufficiently stable that they could kind of continue until after the election. I couldn't figure out what they were talking about. But this was, I think, three separate conversations. They seem to think that, the election would be an the Iraq would be an albatross for Republicans because of their handling, but it wouldn't be dominating the headlines on a day-to-day basis or a demanding resolution, demanding policy. So I thought that was really odd because I would have thought the opposite, that, it's going to continue to sort of be the 800-pound gorilla in this election. And that, you look at Giuliani and Romney and their campaigns, this is a critical plank of their campaigns, is about, dealing with Islamic jihadism and the war on terror. It's a key demarcation line between Giuliani and, as he sees it, between Giuliani and the Democrats. So I was really kind of surprised by this. Now, I wasn't talking to any Giuliani people or anything like that. These were mostly sort of Senate and House people. So, maybe there's a different sense in the campaigns. But maybe the Democrats, inside the Beltway kind of have the same thought that, they need to reframe it slightly To continue to talk about it, though, is more of sort of a foreign policy issue heading into 08.
More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Darren Robert Shaw, Associate Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of several books, including Unconventional Wisdom, and in 2006, The Race to 270, which looks at – oh, we got to talk about this. I keep forgetting – which looks at television advertising and candidate visits on the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections. He also has worked as a senior data analyst for the 1992 Bush-Quayle campaign. He was director of election studies for the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2000, and in 2004 served as a consultant for the Bush-Cheney campaign and the Republican National Committee. Thanks, Bob, for your call. Lines are open. Join the conversation if you would like. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Or you could be the first this Monday to send us an email. And that address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. All Things Political, Mondays at 9, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the Senate passed the first new corporate average fuel economy legislation in more than 30 years. The House energy bill didn't contain the same provision. Our guest the second hour says, as Congress works to come up with a final energy bill, CAFE standards and a renewable electricity standard should be combined that would put America on the path to a new, clean energy future. All right, back to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Professor Darren Robert Shaw, Associate Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin, is our guest. And we go next to Jeff from Moqua. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my
call. Sure.
I'm quite impressed with the lead-in to Professor Shaw's background and everything else he did. And I'm on the opposite end of the political spectrum, and I kind of get a kick because if you really want to see any Republican look like a deer in the headlights, you just ask them to name one thing that's working. And without getting real personal, I guess my question would be, knowing that he was obviously part of the Bush 1, Bush 2 stolen election, how does he feel being part of the downfall of America? And I'll take my answer off the line.
Not what we thought you were going to talk about.
Well, I grew up in San Diego and went to school in Los Angeles at UCLA, and I get a lot of these emails from my friends. It was really interesting, and I'll kind of take myself as an example here of what I think is kind of a general issue in America. That is, during the not so much during 2000, but after 2000, certainly after 9/11 and in the lead up to Iraq, I started getting a lot of these emails about, you know, boy, how can you support this guy? What are you doing? And then during the war, you know, just, boy, you seem like a reasonable guy. How could you possibly, you know, fall in with, you know, this crowd? And how can you continue to support what they're doing? And then there's sort of more public people like Matthew Dowd, who, you know, kind of openly broken with the administration. And, you know, I have some misgivings about, several aspects of the president's administration and what's happened. Some of them I, you know, think are probably less obvious than others. Economic policy, I guess, would be one instance where, and in particular, the deficit and sort of spending that's going on, even when the Republicans, especially, I guess, when the Republicans had control of the Congress, is disconcerting to someone who grew up as kind of a California fiscal conservative in a lot of ways. So, but I was struck by the certainty with which people kind of offered their opinions. Iraq's a disaster. This was something they were saying back in, 2002. And I guess my general reaction is that, I have my preferences and my ideology and my partisanship, and I'm not certain about anything. I sort of, read as much as I can and think as hard as I can about it and make my choices. And, I don't know, though. I have sort of a quantum view of politics, right? It's all probabilistic, and I think you place your bets with where you think the, highest chances of success are. And, I'd be the first to admit, in some instances, those have not worked out well with this administration. But In general, I still have a significant amount of faith in the president and a significant amount of faith in the sorts of policies, even if their application, I think, has been certainly imperfect, that the administration has advanced. But you know what? I could look like an idiot 6 months from right now. Some people think I'm an idiot, and 10 years from now, I may look, you know, even dumber. But you know, that's as kind of specific a defense, I guess, as I want to offer at this point.
Why is it, do you think, that there are so many people who have given up on him? I mean, his polls are just awful. What is it? War? You know, what is it?
I'll go back to Katrina. I think that what, and I told something to a reporter friend of mine back in the summer 2005. I said, you know, I just can't see Bush dropping below 40% approval. Hmm. I thought he had a base of support that would kind of shore him up. That you know, Iraq could be seen as a bad move, and it didn't work out. But I think most people who are supporters of the president would say, well, you know, they gave it a shot, and you know, it was the right thing to do. It didn't work for a lot of reasons, but I didn't think he'd go below 40. I think Katrina and the handling of the national disaster was really important because what Bush had was a perception amongst the public that, well, I don't, even if I don't like him, he's decisive. You know, he's a straight shooter. He takes his shots. And he does what he thinks is right. And the problem with Katrina was I think it was the first and most powerful and damning episode where it looked like he didn't know how to lead. You know, not only was it mishandled, and you know, certainly there Iraq had echoes of that it wasn't handled well, but that, you know, he was indecisive. He was, you know, they didn't do anything in response to a tremendous crisis. And I think that really shook his base. You know, and I think that's why he, you know, that the base was fractured, and at that point, approval was in free fall. Of course, he was never going to get, I don't think, the Democrats back much after Iraq. I just think that was too polarizing. But I thought if the second administration had been handled well and things had gone well, he certainly had a chance to kind of climb up into the 50s with swing voters and independents supporting him. But that just crippled him, and he's never recovered from that. And I think there'll probably be a resurgence towards the end of his administration. There generally is for presidents who are on their way out, but I don't think it's going to get very high. He'll be lucky if he gets back into the 40s, I think.
Jack from Detroit is next. Hi, Jack.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have two questions. Will Bush bomb Iran? Will Hillary continue the war? Thank you.
Okay.
I have absolutely no insight on the first question, you know, whatsoever. I don't know what the policy deliberations are in Iran. I would suggest, though, that the notion that they would do so as some kind of, you know, political maneuver or to raise Bush's popularity or something like that is absolutely, you know, far-fetched. It doesn't work like that. Now, would Hillary continue the Iraq policies? I actually think the differences between and amongst the Republican and Democratic candidates are actually somewhat overstated on Iraq. There are a couple candidates, you know, Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich and others who are talking about withdrawing tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the candidates are talking about some kind of gradual drawdown. The question is there a timetable associated with it? What's the timetable? What's the troop level that persists there? Are you in favor of, you know, a tripartite division of Iraq and those sorts of things? But there's a surprising consensus, and this was true in 2004 during the race with Bush and Kerry. You know, they're really, amongst people who are top-tier candidates and who are probably going to end up winning, there's a surprising consensus as to what to do in Iraq. I actually think that Hillary, you know, the old line, only Nixon could go to China.
Right.
I think Hillary will face strong pressure as a potentially a Democratic candidate, as a female Democratic candidate, to prove her bona fides in defending national security and standing tall against, you know, perceived outside threats.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually think that she would probably have the most conservative position on the war. But that's a guess. I don't mean to, you know, impute preferences that really aren't, you know, aren't obvious.
We go next to Mike from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I just want to say you have an excellent guest on today. I'm way on the other end of the political spectrum as well. But, you know, after listening, you know, I listen to all the right-wing talk shows when I have time. From Sean Hannity and Michael Savage to Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of them. I just have to say that this guy is using his analytical mind, and it's good to hear somebody from the right doing that. And my question.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Gerard Randall, is that the person that's on Channel 10 with you, Kathleen?
Mm-hmm.
Another Republican that's easy to listen to and ponder the issues with, but. What is going to happen with the Republican Party? It seems to me they use the right-wing talk show host and some of the Newt Gingrich has calmed down a little bit and some of the others, but are they going to continue with this beating, the sneering when they say the word liberal and mocking liberals when they say they care about children's issues and so on and so forth? Is that going to end or is that going to continue or get worse now that Karl Rove is gone? And I'd like to hear your response. Thanks.
Sure, thank you. You know, talk radio has a commercial dynamic to it. And this is not to say that Limbaugh and Hannity and others don't, you know, obviously have sincere preference. I don't think you could fake it as well as, you know, they have if it weren't truly sincere. They believe those things. But it's also true that there's a lot of bit players at the subnational level who, you know, who kind of mimic that approach to politics in that style, and they do so because there's an audience for it. And you know, until the audience dries up and kind of gets sick of that sort of conversation, it's going to persist, I think. You know, I do think that there is a real yearning, a sense that, you know, people who are interested in politics would like to hear grown-up conversations. I mean, I the days of Crossfire where people yell at each other and insult each other, I think we've kind of gone past that a little bit. There's still a niche audience for that, but I do think there's a real, real marketplace potentially for serious, informed conversation about the major issues of the day. The problem is, of course, that in the context of a campaign, the incentives are for repetition and focus and simplicity, and I think that always takes an edge off the kind of, you know, talk we're going to get from our candidates and their representatives. And that's regrettable, but, you know, that's kind of the way it is still.
Scott from Appleton, hi.
Good morning. I just wanted to go back to the 2008 election, and I guess I had a question regarding, because I still think, regardless of what Republicans might say in the House and the Senate, I still think Iraq is the big issue. And I think it's going to continue to be, dependent upon how it turns out the next year. And I'm wondering what your guest's opinion is if things progress, if things get better. Because it's always been my opinion, especially when the surge started, when they started talking about it last spring, and the Democrats kept saying it wasn't going to work, it's the wrong thing to do, it wasn't going to work. And now it seems to be working. The Democrats seem to be invested in defeat in Iraq. And the way I mean that is, if things go well, if things progress and get better, that's not a good thing for them because they are so heavily invested in us getting out of there. We can't win. You've heard the mantra about, you know, we're losing the war, we can't win. I'm just wondering how, if in the next 12 months, 10 to 12 months, things really progress there, how that would impact the 2008 election.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. I think two things. The first is your first comment about that despite what Washington insiders say, you think Iraq's going to be a big issue. I actually tend to side with you on that. Maybe they know something that you and I don't, but I'm not quite sure how it's not a huge issue. Now, I take it this election, I think what the Democrats would like to do is make it a referendum on the Bush administration, and Republicans would like to turn it into, you know, a question of what we're going to do, you know, from this point on, obviously. But framing it as a referendum becomes a little problematic if things do improve significantly in Iraq. Now, you could still make, and I'm sure Democrats still will make, a strong case that, well, it doesn't matter. It was still mishandled. Look at all the treasure. Look at all the personal grief and the high, high tragic human cost associated with the war. That will still be a part of it. But I think what happens, though, is if it's, you know, kind of stabilized and there is a political solution, then the question really becomes, okay, what do we do now? And there may be much more significant appetite for the kind of aggressive anti-terror policies that a Giuliani and a Romney are proposing, to a lesser extent Hillary Clinton, than say, you know, kind of a John Edwards or a Barack Obama, where it's much more about multinational engagement and negotiation and the sort of thing that I guess has been, you know, typified by the Carter and then the Clinton administrations, the two most recent Democratic administrations. I still say, though, boy, I think Senator Clinton has positioned herself kind of brilliantly in this regard. I mean, she's got the critique of the Bush administration's handling, but she has not necessarily repudiated, you know, a strong stance or an aggressive foreign policy or the president's right to commit troops in this sort of way.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Professor Shaw, for being with us. Please join us again. It was a great hour.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Professor Darren Robert Shaw, Associate Professor of Government at the University of Texas at Austin, and he is author of, most recently, Unconventional Wisdom. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and to Rhonda as well for on-air production. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll return on the Ideas Network.